Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Daily Friend, the Friday edition. Just watch out for the podcast, which will also be released today. Remember, we're on every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. I've got a full house with me today. Guys, good morning. Welcome. Franz Cronier, who's the CEO of the Institute of Race Relations. Good day. Good morning.
Good morning.
We have Sara Gunn, who is our chief editor of the Daily Friend. Good morning, Sara.
Hi, Sikha.
And, of course, we have Gabriel Krauser, sorry, I couldn't think of your surname for a moment, who's one of our writers and analysts on the Daily Friend and at the Institute. Good morning, how are you doing?
How's it, man?
Awesome. Guys, jam-packed show, let's jump straight into it. The lingo of the day, the word on everybody's lips is, will there be reform? The dust is settling in terms of choosing of MPs and cabinet, and the president, et cetera, in parliament, but the reform message. Are we hearing it, Franz?
Yeah, well, we point you to a piece in the Daily Friend this morning. I think it's the top bit. And it deals with this question and does so really well through the writings of our colleague Terence Corrigan. And I quote for you. He says, all eyes are now on the new cabinet and parliament that's coming in the next week. And the question becomes, who's in, who's out? Is it bigger? Is it smaller? And Terence goes on to say, this is sort of a wonderful, he says, procedural drama. And provides a lot of fodder to columnists and analysts who speculate about what it means. But Terence says there's a paradox in this. And the paradox is that the speculation about procedure is paired with what he calls a remarkable complacency, that if the procedure changes, so will the direction of policy. Mm. And I think it's a very important point. I spoke at a dinner in Pretoria earlier this week about reform, and they said, well, you didn't really seem to suggest that there was much on the way. Mm. And I said to the dinner, but if I'd told you that reform was now imminent and one of you had stood up and asked me for the evidence of policy reform, I wouldn't have much to give you.
That's right.
In areas of labor or empowerment or whatever the case is. Go to the Daily Friend today, read Terence's piece. There's a lot of value in it.
Absolutely, guys. Remember, all of our writers can be found on the Daily Friend, www.dailyfriend.co.za. Guys, this is a broader issue, though. We've been talking about reform on the show. In fact, we spoke of it too when we were at NAMPO to an extent. There's no evidence of there being reform, but there's clearly evidence of there being jostling within the party, albeit of characters within the party. David Mabuza was not sworn in as an MP. What's going on there? Thoughts on this?
Yeah, I'm jumping in again because I've got a view on this. And that's that there's a lot of foolishness going on. And the suggestion that Mabuza, suddenly at the end of his long track record, has decided to do things the right way. And this shows that Ramaphosa's sort of struggle to improve governance in the country is paying off. I don't think that's the case at all. It's a very clever thing, perhaps, that Mr. Mabuza has done. Because in exiting Parliament and exiting the post of Deputy President of the country, he of course, retains the role in the ANC.
As Deputy President.
And what he's able to do then is to begin the process of clearly establishing two centres of power in the country. Mm. One of them in the union buildings, to be run by Mr. Ramaphosa and his advisers, and a second to crystallise around the African National Congress itself. Mm. And the warning in that is, I'm going to ask Thabo Mbeki, what happens next when you do that in the ANC?
I think one of the problems with Mabuza is he's ostensibly responding to what the Integrity Commission of the ANC has found or has on him, and some people have suggested that it's he's suddenly developed a conscience. A person like David Mabuza is unlikely to have suddenly developed a conscience, and in any event, he's got to come out of that commission absolutely fine, because he simply has to deny anything they present. They are not going to present witnesses. They do not have decision-making power. They can only recommend. Mm. So I think it is a strategic move, and he's not going to come off any worse for it.
Yeah, and if you sort of got like a shallow kind of analysis of South Africa, and then you formally, yes, Parliament is where it happens. In practice, the centre of power is Lithuli House.
Mm. Yeah.
Everything else becomes a subcommittee of Lithuli House. If you want to control the thing, you want to control operations in Lithuli House, and you want to isolate everyone around you. And if you're able to do that, and the occupant of the union buildings undershoots on what the party or the public demands of him, it's very clear where the balance of power in the country is shifting. Mm.
And also just to bring back something we talked about last week, there's something symbolically or rhetorically very useful about having a good cop, bad cop kind of setup.
Mm.
So you've got Ramaphosa coming out, spreading the good news, making Parliament seem super clean to the satisfaction of The Economist and The New York Times. And then you've got the real center of power, and its levers are well-oiled. Ace Magashule is kind of the magistrate behind both good cop and bad cop. And so you've got like a real strong trajectory, but sort of behind this fig leaf.
I think anybody listening to this would be rather concerned, because it would point to essentially the broader point we've been making here, which is there's no evidence of things likely moving in a direction of necessary and required reform. And then equally with this, I think quite an apt theory, really, if you look at the actual evidence of what's happening, a real fear around the ANC not learning the lesson of an electoral slide in this last election. What do you think their reasoning is around, or what? How do you think they would view what is happening, what we're postulating may be happening, as a comeback for the ANC? How does it play into it being a possible comeback for the ANC?
I think quite an odd thing happens, in that I think the ANC's diagnosis of where the country is pretty good. I think a lot of the analysis that's done in this building and the sort of organizations associated with us, and mainstream ANC analysis of the economy or protests or unemployment or the implications of current policy. I'd say, and people would be surprised to hear it, there's a lot of agreement. But the ANC's response to that is different to the response that Western analysts or organized business expects. I could go as far as to say, there's some agreement on the diagnosis of what's wrong, and if I said nothing else, the implication would be, well, they're about to implement the requisite reforms. That's not the case. And for me, there are two big reasons for that. One is structure inside the ANC itself. It isn't a lean, mean operation. It's not a chief executive with extraordinary powers and an efficient small board. You've got to run these decisions through this broad NEC. The second reason is ideology, always undercounted by Western analysts and business leaders, and its importance on decision making. And related to the ideology is criminality and corruption. That many of the people responsible for making these decisions inside the ANC could, let's say the reforms throw open the way to the effective prosecution of people who've looted the fiscus. That buck will stop with you. So what is the motivation for you to actually support a campaign of real reform, of really cleaning up the government? And therefore it stalls, it stagnates, the system freezes, even though, and I will maintain this because I know enough, the understanding inside the ANC is very good about the social and economic problems and their long-term implications.
I think to some extent, you almost saw that dichotomy in Ramaphosa's speech in Parliament. A, it was twice as long as it needed to be, because he repeated himself over and over again, saying there would be change, people expect change, we must make a difference to the masses of the people, which is a phrase I loathe because it just indicates no one's an individual. But he talked about change, he talked about being understanding exactly what you're saying, but they were always almost in the third person. You never got a sense that we're sorry for what's happened. Mm. We've really strayed. We have to get back on track, and we undertake to do that. They undertake, yes, but it was so broad and so wishy-washy. Whereas Ace Magashule, earlier this week, he was absolutely certain that we're going the path of the NDR and all that involves.
And why shouldn't he be confident? The DA has reversed its gains for the first time in history. The ANC, if it manages to bring the EFF back into the fold, which Ace Magashule has called for and Cyril Ramaphosa has called for, would win back its supermajority overnight. So I think there's a political calculation that is at odds with the economic calculation that says sort of we are on a path of a shrinking electorate but an increasingly radicalized electorate, one that sort of buys into the narratives that the media and we ourselves are trying to punt. And so if we keep doubling down, it's going to work out. I maintain that the only way the ANC can break out of this sort of dilemma where it if it's going to do what it says it wants to do and what it needs to do, it needs to fire half of itself.
Mm.
Now, there's no one who's going to fire themselves, right? These angels do not tread on the earth we walk together. And so what they really need to do is open up their primary system so that the voters, so that the ANC base can get in there and say, we want this one, we don't want that one. So that you can have you start having debates within the ANC. Instead of having debates, you have this person using this platform to say this and that person using that platform to say that. And as you say, Cyril Ramaphosa using the same platform to say both. If you had real debate within the ANC publicly, that would force people to stake out positions, and then some of them would be whittled away by an electorate that's miffed with this, and then you'd stand a real chance. If they don't do that, I don't think that there's a way that they're going to dig themselves.
And Gabriel's bang on here. The ANC is not sitting on 57%. It's sitting on 57 plus 10,
yeah,
which is essentially where it's been sitting for 25 years.
Mm. Okay. That was dark and lugubrious. now that we've got that out of the way, guys, let's shift focus. Gabriel, I'm gonna start with you on this one. In the news cycle yesterday, AfriForum comes out and says, look, we're going to represent the Coligny farmers, if I'm pronouncing that properly. Two chaps who were convicted of murder of a, I think, 13-year-old? 16-year-old boy. Talk to us about that case, your recollection of it, and then where you think this is heading in terms of AfriForum's inclusion in the matter now.
So when I first heard about this case, it was very clear to me. Peter Derivat and Philip Skitter are guilty as sin, and they must rot in jail. Mm. I started reading through the court transcripts, 1,000 pages, started looking through the annexures of the evidence. It's sort of, I've been sitting with this for months with Rian Milan and James Myberg, and it seems pretty clear to me that justice has not been done in finding them guilty of murder. Mm-hmm. There's three basic reasons. One is that the entire case was based off the state's lone eyewitness, whose name is Bendel Pakisi. He's a part-time butcher. His pictures on Facebook are mostly of him in bed or sort of grabbing women by various body parts.
No.
He said, sort of a couple of days after the fact, he was recorded as saying, look, I saw this happen. I saw these two white farm workers, these two fat white men, throwing Mushwe off the back of the bucky repeatedly. They saw me see them, so they came and tortured me. They took me on a hell ride over 60 Ks and made me run and drink liquor and vomit and then eat my own vomit, and they made me dance above bullets flying around my ankles and then nearly killed me, and eventually they knocked me out. And when I came to, I tried going to the police wouldn't listen to me, so I came back and I tried again. And these guys are murderers. Now, the problem with Pakisi's story that everyone knows is that after the trial was concluded, he said, I made it all up, to four eyewitnesses, for a priest and various others. Then he said that he was intimidated into saying that, slash bribed 5 million rand or something like that into saying it, which sounds like a lot of money for Coligny. There's really not a lot going there. But that aside, in his testimony presented before the court, there were various contradictions. For example, he started saying there are two guys. Then he said there were three assailants. That's one of over a dozen material contradictions that the judge literally just didn't even look at in his final judgment. Mm. There were some contradictions that were pretty minor that he addressed, but the really big ones he did not address. Mm. That's the first reason. The second reason is the forensic evidence, which was very hard to look at because it's a lot of photos of this dead boy. The forensic pathologist, two forensic pathologists were in play, a Dr. Letabele and a Dr. Murad, who's the possibly the only specialist forensic pathologist in the Northwest Province. Mm. It was a high-profile case, so she was called in 8 days after the fact to do an autopsy. And the most remarkable thing she found about Mashwe's body was that there were no injuries to his palms, the back of his hands, or his wrists. Now, if you fall off of something and you want to break your fall, there's a kind of a natural primitive reflex that's going to have you put your hands out there so that you protect
break
your face.
Fall, yeah.
So that obviously didn't happen. That's a bit weird. It turns out that his fall, the injuries that he suffered, a major bruise here, some bruising here, some bruising on his knees, is consistent with him jumping out and doing a tuck roll, like you might have seen sort of Jean-Claude Van Damme do.
Right.
So it was consistent with that. The problem is that Pakisi, the eyewitness, who said he saw this guy falling out of the bucky, being thrown out of the bucky, he described the fall like a swimmer's dive. His body horizontal, his head slightly below, his feet flying towards the ground. How were his hands? extended out and above his head.
So they actually asked him that with him.
In court, in front of the judge. The judge even sort of repeated the gesture that Pakisi made of him putting his hands out above his head. That's exactly what would have produced the kinds of injuries that the doctor said weren't there.
There's clearly a lot of inconsistencies here. Sorry,
One more thing, because this is possibly the most important one.
Yeah.
These guys had the farm workers had three cell phones on them. They made like 30 transactions in the relevant 3 hours that Thursday morning. Mm. And all of those cell phone transactions were routed through one of two towers sort of in the vicinity of Kalingi. Mm-hmm. But now the eyewitnesses' account says that they went on a massive circle almost all the way to Lichtenberg and back, which would have taken sort of an hour and a half, 2 hours, at the very fastest an hour. Mm. But they were making calls, the longest gap is sort of 15 minutes. Mm. So there's no ways, according to the cell phone evidence, that they could have been where he says they were, taking him on this journey. The judge only mention of the cell phone evidence was that one of the cell phones had a gap of an hour at the wrong time, not recognizing that the other two cell phones were highly active in that period. So it just looks like the judge wasn't perhaps paying attention. But here's why this story is important. I think that one of the sort of untold hardcore beliefs in bourgeois South Africa, in the leafy suburbs of Joburg and Pretoria and Cape Town and Durban, is that while politics might be lugubrious and very miserable, as you said, and while the economy might be struggling, our courts at least remain watertight, they remain secure, they remain credible institutions of justice. And I think the Kalingi case, it's not alone, but it is the most high-profile murder case of late. It's been covered in the international news. The New York Times has written about it on several occasions. And it just does not seem like the courts are what we think they are. Kalingi was burnt down and ransacked. The mob, in the terms of Rian Malan, was hungry for white flesh. And it seems like everything has been done to satisfy that hunger. Mm. And without due diligence and without respect for the rule of law.
Okay. Can I just say, with a comment on the legal process, is the judge in the case has now refused leave to appeal for the two guys. Yeah. So they now have to apply for appeal directly to the Supreme Court of Appeals.
Oh, right, sorry.
And one of the grounds for appeal is the possible likelihood that a different judge would come to a different conclusion.
Yeah.
Now, this is a case, I read the judgment very sort of cursorily, and it was really, I would go so far, probably further than Gabriel to say that it looked like there was more than just incompetence at play in this judgment. And I think he's absolutely right. But it's been for a long while. The general view has been that if you're going to go to court on almost anything, you don't worry about the first line of that is going to go against you. You've got to start getting into the appeals process before you start seeing something that resembles judicial system.
One last thing about the judgment that's very disturbing. The judge singled out one warrant officer, Seponkane, who knew Bendel Pakisi, the eyewitness, in advance and said this guy's not trustworthy and so didn't believe his story when he first came to be. Also said he was very drunk. The judge said Seponkane is a very bad guy. He must be disciplined. He wasn't being respectful to the eyewitness. Now, Seponkane did not appear before the court, although he'd been subpoenaed. He went on record citing fear of his life and the life of his family. The judge did not recognize that. The judge did not ask the police or the public prosecutor to investigate why it is that an officer of the South African Police Service would say, I don't want to come to court and speak under oath in the public because I'm afraid for my life.
Mm.
That is worth investigation.
There's something deeply worrying here. And I think as a liberal, I look at this and I go, well, you know, you want to build a society that is founded in the rule of law. And rule of law comes with a lot of conditions, if you will. I don't know what word to insert there, where the law is not supposed to pay heedance to what's happening outside. justice should be what are the material facts in terms of a court case presented to it, and you know, even if it's not PC, so to speak, justice should prevail.
Without fear or favor.
There's something very deeply troubling about this, isn't there?
But particularly in a murder case, because it's a criminal case.
Yeah.
A criminal case, you have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the accused are guilty. So if there is any reasonable doubt, you've got to find for them, not against them.
Mm.
And this seems to be one of those cases.
Well, there's now. I mean, this thing should go to the appeal court. I've read Gabriel's and Rian and James Myburgh's stuff, and this thing should end up in front of the appeal court, and they should look at it very closely, and we'll follow that very closely.
Absolutely.
Because it's very important. It's a very important a litmus test now, a canary in a sense, about and maybe they'll find that the original judge came to exactly the right decision. But let's do that now in the full glare of public scrutiny.
Absolutely. Guys, you can look out for that. I'm sure Gabriel will be following this and writing on it on the Daily Friend. Remember, you find all our writing at www.dailyfriend.co.za. Guys, let's move on. onto a topic which I think we've somewhat exhausted on this show, but I want us to revisit it because I think a very good piece by John Kane Berman will be coming out on Monday on that much vaunted topic of black privilege versus white privilege. What should people expect?
It's just a heads up to watch that. You know, John's one of the great South African columnists and observers of our national condition. And Monday in the Daily Friend, I've read the piece. He's produced a really good assessment of the questions of privilege and how we need to address those as a society. Mm-hmm.
Guys, on race, another famous figure who caused, again, uproar on social media, one Mr. Katsavelos in a straw hat on a beach in Greece is now going to be finding himself in front of a judge, essentially facing, what are the charges? Would it be criminal injuria, likely?
Criminal injuria, which is essentially criminal defamation. Laid by the EFF, by the way.
We spoke about this, France, and, you know, obviously, this chap is an absolutely abhorrent character. I mean, we all saw that video. Absolutely wrong. He's a racist. He's an actual racist. But there's a bigger principle here, isn't there, Franz?
Yeah, it's quite a challenge for society how you deal with this. Comments he made, utterly disgraceful, offensive to millions of people. Like that slur in this country, I mean, goes without saying. Mm. A racist, there's no doubt. All of that, bank it. Question is, what do you do with it now? Appears in, I think, the Randburg Magistrates Court next week. What do you do as a society? How do you hang him? I mean, do we open the gallows again in Pretoria? Is that what we want? And why this is an issue for us is the nature of the offence. It was a thought that entered his head, an opinion he held, and a view he expressed in public. And how does society handle or punish people who hold views that the society disagrees with? It's critically important a question. The thesis of this group is that if such actions risk imminent physical harm to another person, then you have a case to take issue with. However, be very careful of the precedent that is being set around this. If the society demands that people be punished severely for ideas that thought crimes, in a sense, or spoken crimes, what is the precedent that is being established?
Yeah.
Particularly in a society where questions of governance and the rule of law are not as solid as they should be. There's some bad chaps around. We've spoken about the sort of wrestle between, on this now, on this bit, the sort of wrestling for power between potential reformists and some real thugs in the ANC. And we're not going to go and bat for this Katsavelos character. Mm-hmm. He created this. He's got to deal with the consequences. We will just around it ask the question of think through the long-term implications of punishing a person for the thoughts that they hold. Not that the thoughts aren't racist. They are.
Yeah.
Terribly so. You do not get more racist than this. But where are you later down the line? I had occasion this week to encounter a person of limited means of Zimbabwean origin, and somehow our paths crossed and we spoke to each other for 15 minutes. And as she exclaimed with no prompting to me how terrible conditions are in that country and how pleased she is to be able to be in South Africa. And how then, without further prompting, she said to me how South Africans must be careful that they don't inadvertently, with the best of intentions, the eradication of racism, sound intention, put in place the sort of circumstances that wrecked her country,
and which erode freedoms.
It's in any assessment of what's going to happen next week in this Katsavelos case, that point that we've made deserves, on the merits, to be included in that assessment.
The other thing that worries me a lot, and it comes back to the previous case, the Kalinia case, is the extent to which we're conflating a really stupid racist comment that offended people, but no one thought their livelihood or their lives were at stake because of, versus the Kalinia case, where a murder trial appears to have been very badly handled and political and nefarious reasons seem to have played a role. Suddenly you're conflating a stupid statement with a really serious crime. They're both becoming crimes, one's as equal as the other. That's a huge problem.
I think my concern is the not so much the baying for blood. I mean, I think people are right to be angry about this. They're right to take offense. My concern is the coalition of individuals who then sort of coalesce around this with the view of introducing measures that give them the sort of power to police thought, to police language, so that it becomes a slippery slope, so that now it isn't just you using the K word. It could be saying, hey, you. What do you mean, hey, you? You know what I mean? Like, it becomes a weird slippery slope that certain people are baying for the opportunity to have that power to be able to do this. And freedoms, and freedom of speech is one of them, often suffers when this sort of thing happens.
Yeah. The question is this, and very often it is people whose professions are the realm of ideas, journalists, academics and the like, who in our country will be the first to attempt to shut down opinion. And the question is this, what is the better bet here? Is it to allow the shutting down of an opinion that you disagree with, even where it's an outrageously offensive opinion, such as in this case, and then essentially rolling the dice on hoping that this will never happen to the views that you hold?
Yeah.
Your views might not be offensive. They might be perfectly legitimate, but the precedent is established. Is rolling the dice on that the better bet? Or is the better bet actually saying that part of being a mature and fundamentally free and open society is tolerating hateful speech in the long-term pursuit of the security of knowing that if that is tolerated, then any ideas or thoughts or opinions that you might one day express in the future South Africa, you don't know what will happen, those ideas and thoughts will also be protected. And that is the question that freedom of speech and related activists need to confront. And we don't do it openly enough. And the risk in that is that you set these precedents that you will later come to regret.
And just one sort of question that dovetails with that is, do you think the South African economy of esteem, the marketplace of ideas, the public square, is powerful enough to sort out these problems itself, or does it need the backing of the state? Mm. One of the things that people like to talk about is sort of 1940s, 1950s Germany, where the public square had been completely destroyed. South Africa's got this very ironic thing where we like to talk up how strong our independent media is, and at the same time talk up how we really need the iron fist of the government to come and help out the media and help out social media and help out sort of public discourse to right these silly wrongs. Mm. No, silly wrongs, terrible wrongs.
Maybe let me segue quite smoothly then into the issue of where the state should be playing a role, and that is in the enforcement of the rule of law, essentially. Mm-hmm. There is a big problem right now. We're talking about this offline, about what's happening here in Johannesburg, and even in Cape Town, but we'll get to that. Something's happening in the Oval. What? Talk to us about that.
Okay, so last weekend, a young man, the two names escape me. I just know that they happen to be Zulus.
Yep.
Was killed. There was a funeral in the sort of public square in Yeovil. His brother lifted a gun up and shot bullets into the air. Mm. The police arrived. As far as I understand from the reports, there was an exchange of fire. This is it, they've sort of believe that it's illegal to go shooting in the middle of the park. But the sort of engagement did not go well, and the police ended up killing the brother as well. And what ensued then was fires, burning tires, blockades all around Yeovil, a lot of harassment, a lot of the police then going around and looking for anyone that's armed, trying to disarm them, trying to figure out. And there's sort of this battle between this a group that's coalesced around these two brothers that are passed and the police. And every night Yeovil's basically been subject to a self-imposed curfew. No one on the streets after 6 o'clock at all. No one on the streets until sunrise the next day. A lot of people barricading their homes, trying to cut away things, worried about fires. There's a funeral happening on Saturday, which looks to be the next major sort of tinderbox. Whether it'll light or not is unclear. But it's unfortunately in South Africa is the kind of thing that happens a lot of the time. I think part of what's remarkable about this case is that it's happening in a suburb that is next to the central business district of the richest city in Africa, and yet it's unmanaged. And sort of there are lower degree sort of examples of this kind of thing playing out. I've been talking with some ward councillors who've brought forward cases of fake city power trucks going around and stealing transformers, which are extremely expensive equipment that need to then be replaced. Mm. Brixton, Auckland Park, very close to our offices, Parktown North, Roosevelt Park, a power station that's next to an old age home. This is crazy. Also in Melville, just around us, Picky Tub, I've seen footage of Picky Tubs being stolen by Picky Tub drivers. So it's like the lawlessness that we sometimes associate with our neighboring countries, that we sometimes associate, that I certainly know quite well, and I know you know well from rural parts of KZN. Instead of the rule of law spreading from those parts of South Africa that had better resources into those parts that didn't have better resources, it seems like the flow is the other way. And it's anarchic, and it kind of means that if you're wealthy enough to hire your own private security and put up your own barricades, then you stand a good chance. You don't stand a great chance because those things get penetrated too. But especially for people who can't afford to do that, it's chaos.
Maybe just as a final question on this point, because I think there's a broader issue here at play. We have had a government in this country that has just not taken safety and security seriously, from the ANC deploying its cadres as police commissioners or infiltrating the intelligence services and using them as, their political playground, if you will. The effects of that are seen in small incidents. And again, I say small with a touch of salt, but in the lived experience of South Africans who now barricade themselves in their homes, whether you're rich or you're poor, there's a curfew by the sounds of things, but technically we've always had a curfew. Some of us don't even stop at red lights after a certain hour in this country. Tell me why it is a major problem, France, for a government which fails on safety and security to also not empower its citizens to take charge of their own communities.
Well, I mean, there's this ironic thing that happens, that wherever we see the overzealous intrusion of the powerful state and the revolutionary agenda behind it, such as in sort of a radical transformation of the police, what tends to happen is you create an impetus and demand for the private sector to fill the gap. Yeah. And the elites in society remain well off, or will perhaps become even better off. But it's a relatively poor that are on the receiving end of the consequences of misguided revolutionary ideology in the country. And there's my statistics a little bit dated, probably 3 or 4 years old, but it's roughly this, that in 94 there were about 100,000 private security officers in the country and 100,000 boots on the ground policemen who did, probably not sitting in an office, but did police work. And a few years back, not very many, I think the figure was around 150,000 boots on the ground policemen and almost 500,000 private security officers, including the best of the original 100,000 policemen. Mm-hmm. Now, what is the point of this? I mean, what has been achieved through the sort of revolutionary transformation of the police? All that's happened is that the elites in society have safeguarded themselves within those statistics, the implication is profound that the private sector has, in response to the failure of the revolutionary ideology, appropriated for itself the monopoly on the use of force in the society, which is the definitive feature of the modern state. Mm. And time and time and time again it happens. And that is why, that's the answer to your question. That is why it's important. Because the rich, the well-off, the bourgeois, as my colleague Gabriel refers to the middle classes, continue to do well in South Africa. You can complain, you can moan, there are very serious problems given. But it is poor communities that inherit the consequences of misguided policy and ideology, and not enough analysts are prepared to concede that, and the ideologues and those who back the ideology actively conceal that fact from the sort of public square of ideas.
And I'll get to you just now, Gabriel, but what really annoys me the most is that this is not just a South Africa thing. You see this in nearly all societies that have gone down this pathway of socialism, if you will, and revolutionary ideology. Venezuela is no exception. The rich still are, you can still find rich people in Venezuela, but they live in these little enclaves with private security, high walls, gated access, and the poor are the ones who, you know, suffer the consequences of Caracas, for example, being one of the most violent cities in the world. All the while, the politicians clap on and say, oh, look, everything is fine. We still have rich folk. We still have malls. We still have all these so-called capitalist amenities. But really, it's a big divide that you're creating in a society. Gabriel,
yeah,
sorry.
Yeah, if you know anyone who's sort of worked for the UN or any of the militaries in Somalia or Sudan, or they live in compounds.
Absolutely.
With private police, and and they can have fabulously high-quality lives. You just can't go very far. Mm. I just want to point out John Kane Berman last year, in terms of this myth that our courts are really still really effective, he gave a talk about the Constitutional Court's legacy. Mm. And one of the most disturbing rulings that continues to sit in my mind was a Constitutional Court ruling that within the police service itself, it is better to hire no one at all than to hire a perfectly qualified white person.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
That ruling came under Chief Justice Mokgoeng, and I think it sends exactly the wrong signal.
Mm. And can I just say, there are a number of constitutional court cases that raise exactly that concern. I won't go into now. But if a government did nothing but provide security and safety for the people of its country successfully, it would be doing fine. The rest can be done with the private sector and the public sector.
Right.
Safety and security, if they can provide that, everything else becomes possible.
Guys, let's look to wrap up, because this is arguably one of the longest episodes of the Daily Friend, but I'm hoping you guys are enjoying it. Remember, you can find all our content, all our writings, and hard, solid analysis from our guys in the Daily Friend. That's www.dailyfriend.co.za. Guys, the last topic I really want us to sort of chew the fat on is, you know, political activists who remain, or those, almost a selective release that we've seen in this country of political activists, you know, people who did a myriad of things back fighting the apartheid system. It would seem that the vast majority of the ones who still languish in prison are those who are not necessarily linked to the ANC. Franz, I'm going to go straight to you on this one, and we'll open up the conversation.
It's a broader question than that, and it's exactly in line with where this conversation has gone this morning.
Yeah,
Kenny Motsamai yesterday makes a comment on this outside the parliamentary precinct about Liberation Era veterans, guerrillas, who remain in prison. Now, Mr. Motsamai's case, we're not completely familiar with, but the evidence, there seems to be no doubt, is as a young man he would leave South Africa. He's a PAC operative, receives his training in Ethiopia, returns to South Africa as part of UPLA. They commit a robbery in pursuit of liberation struggle to fundraise for the PAC, and it's a shambolic thing. And the police catch them, and a traffic policeman is killed.
Yep.
And this is the very late 1980s, and Mr. Motsamai is sentenced to a very long term in prison. His appeal yesterday was for the veterans of the armed struggle who remain in jail in South Africa today. Now, we are fairly sure that there are some of those. Individuals who left South Africa as youngsters, were trained around the world, infiltrated back into the country, and engaged in acts often of violence, mm-hmm. destruction of property and the like in an attempt to undermine the apartheid system. And the fact that some of them continue to languish in prison, where their intentions were motivated by a desire to undermine the system, I think is a very serious problem. It's actually a disgraceful stain on the country and a comment on the callousness of much of the present leadership of the country, where they were genuine youngsters. Ideologically, most of them would have been adversaries of this organization and its position. They would have pursued a more socialist agenda. Ours a very much more liberal agenda through that same era. What makes the position worse is that they do not appear to be MK or ANC operatives in the main, but rather former members of the Pan-Africanist Congress in APLA and perhaps some of the Azanian peoples of ZAPO. And I think Mr. Motsamai's plea, he's now an EFF MP. Mm-hmm. So we're not going to bat for the EFF, but sure, we're going to bat for the issue and the principle. His plea yesterday needs to be heard, and we would certainly give some support to any effort to try and identify who of the real veterans of the liberation struggle who are entitled to some form of amnesty. Whether they applied for it or not, ours is irrelevant. We would give some support to an inquiry into who they are, where they are, what their cases are, and if they are still there, that they be released from prison.
It's interesting that the ANC hasn't done anything about this. And it's not because, obviously, they were the opposition. I mean, it becomes obvious from Anthea Jeffrey's book, The People's War, which is we've talked about, and is in that the ANC took on its black opposition in order to gain hegemony. Mm. It's the fact that after 25 years of sort of near absolute rule, the ability to give amnesty and to have some empathy for people who they consider the enemy and aren't large in numbers, have no power now, they're completely removed from society. It literally would, in all practical terms, be no skin off their nose. And certainly in emotional and ideological terms, it would show a certain, I don't know, giving. I can't think of the right word offhand. And that hasn't happened. And it does show a sort of very retributive element that is misplaced.
But there's no surprise in that, because I mean the Western media at the time, of course, pretended that they couldn't see this. But the in the latter decades of the apartheid system, the ANC acts with unspeakable cruelty towards its black rivals, especially the Black Consciousness Movement. And that is the point I make. It's an issue that needs to be aired. It's not understood if you understand or you've only ever heard the Hollywood version of South Africa's liberation. I had to explain this to an American yesterday who just thought it was the most eye-opening thing that there were black rivals to the ANC, such as the Pan-Africanist Congress.
And it's not just Americans. When I was at high school just 10, 11 years ago, my high school textbook said that all quote-unquote black-on-black violence was instigated by the third force, sort of white dudes in blackface going around shooting people up. This is, you know, an elite private high school.
Yeah, and we're about to set off on a little book launch for my colleague Anthea Jeffrey, who has redone the People's War book that was first published a number of years ago. I think their launch is in Johannesburg, certainly coming up soon, Cape Town and some other places.
We'll provide those details.
And we'll be joined on the stage at those launches. The Joburg one, I think, is at Exclusives in Hyde Park and on the website, and particularly we'll give you the details. We'll be joined on the stage by Ishmael Mkabela, who was the founding president of ZAPO and has a much first-hand experience of what we're talking about here. And it's very important that the stories of these guys be told and understood, and that they no longer be concealed. And you know, this chap, Mr. Motsamai, yesterday, maybe he just set something really important into motion. Yeah.
Guys, thank you very much. I will end it there. And thank you for joining us and watching. I know this has been one of the longest ones. But we really wanted to chat to you guys about some of these issues. And again, guys, let me remind you, you can find all our writing and some of these lovely pieces that we've been discussing here as they become written pieces on the Daily Friend website. That's www.dailyfriend.co.za. And as always, guys, we look to you to support us in our work. Become a friend of the IRR. That is our crowdfunding campaign. And you can do that quite simply by SMSing your name to 32823. A SMS will cost you 1 rand, and terms and conditions apply. Remember, guys, we average between 70 and 90 rand per person per month. And you can sign up via debit order. You can also do that online at www.irr.org.za/join. Guys, thank you so much. Remember to like, share, and subscribe to the show and hit that bell notification so you get notified whenever any of our shows, whether it's the Big Liberty Show or Daily Friend or any of our content is put up there. Look out for the podcast, which also comes out today. And we'll see you next week.